Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Cheryl Vint. She is professor of media and cultural studies and of English at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about her new book, Science Fiction. Cheryl, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
There's an awful lot in this book. Now, you're an editor of the journal Science Fiction Studies, and a book series, Science and Popular Culture. Is this MIT Press book, which is part of the Essential Knowledge series, is this sort of a distillation of some of the things you've talked about in other books?
It is and it isn't. I mean, it's certainly, as with all the MIT Press books, it's an attempt to give a concise yet comprehensive overview of what science fiction is. But because it's published with MIT, I really focused a lot on connections with scientific practice,
yeah,
more so than I necessarily would in some other venues. So that's the kind of slant, and that has everything to do with the series the book is in.
You asked the question in the beginning of the book, how might science fiction help us conceptualize and respond to a world that's begun to resemble science fiction? Things really are rapidly evolving. And that's one of your major points in this book is what is science fiction? Is it just an extrapolation of scientific sort of findings, or is it a literature for social change? And that's a big question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's both and to different degrees in different contexts. But I think one of the things we really see with science fiction today that's both exciting but sometimes a little overwhelming is it's just become such an important tool in so many venues. I mean, we have people planning future cities and people thinking about environmental mitigation in arcologies, or people thinking about climate change or synthetic biology or robots and automation and the future of work. I mean, I used to be, when I started working on science fiction studies, it was, you know, one could reasonably stay on top of everything relevant that was going on in the field. And increasingly today, it's, you know, historians and ethicists and roboticists and city planners and just all these other professions are engaging with the tools of science fiction. So
it's interesting to me because I interview a lot of these people, and I often get the feeling like as a youth, or maybe not as a youth, as an adult, they've read a lot of speculative fiction and then said, yeah, why don't we do that? It's like,
yeah, and there certainly are some people, I mentioned some of them in the book, like Colin Milburn is one, who've done some really great research looking at precisely those kinds of influences. I mean, it's never quite so simple as, you know, you want a transporter, you build a transporter, if only.
If only it was.
Exactly. I would definitely sign up for that invention. But I think certainly the idea that this is what I try to convey in the book is science fiction is essentially about this idea that technology can change the social world.
Right.
And so whether that's, you know, motivated by questions of social structure that people want to change, or motivated by questions more of infrastructure, those emphases can fall differently. But it really is about imagining tools for change.
One of the things that becomes apparent in your book is that the definition of what science fiction is and what it should aspire to has really changed within the 20th century. And I'm thinking specifically of John Campbell's sort of technocratic version of what he would call hard sci-fi.
Yes, yes.
Some people have said that was the worst thing that ever happened to science fiction was John Campbell.
Actually, yeah, I probably would be aligned with those kind of people. I mean, I think one of the sort of interesting things about John Campbell is he becomes the editor of Amazing Stories when he's like 23, maybe. He's in his early 20s. And then he keeps that job for like 50-some years. So I think that kind of centrality of power and one person's vision shaping the field could happen when it was sort of a small niche genre. But today we see so many people from different countries, from different ethnic traditions, from different sort of backgrounds in relationship to science, both writing science fiction or starting their own magazines, that nobody really has that sort of central role anymore. So I do think, like, I don't think his technocratic vision was the best science fiction could be anyways, but I also think, like, no one can have that kind of centrality anymore as he could in an earlier moment in the genre's history.
No, it's incredible. Science fiction today is as varied as the people are on the planet. And there are now traditions within traditions within traditions and sensibilities and stuff like that. Frederick Jameson, you quote him in the book, he believes that science fiction's position is for us to think critically about the future. And I can actually see that. That, you know, a lot of these dystopian visions that happen, we'll talk about utopian and dystopian just next, but it really makes you, how do we prevent that from happening is what science fiction is doing.
Yeah, that one of the sort of ways that fandom likes to talk about this is the if this goes on story, so that you're looking at the trajectory of choices in the present. And that's sort of part of Jameson's idea, is that we start to think of the present as the history of the future in a way, so that we understand what we're doing in terms of the trajectory for a future it implies. And I think that's one of the reasons why the genre has been so useful for people wanting to think about things like climate change, that it requires us to recognize that we are every day making a future. And then we want to think about, like, is it the one we want to be making?
It's interesting, because even before Campbell, there was a completely different attitude towards science fiction. I'm thinking of Hugo Gernsback, which was basically just big pulp stories, you know, men's adventures in space.
Yeah, certainly a lot of what Gernsback published was the sort of, like, men's adventure in space, and there was a lot of similarity to kind of colonial adventure fiction. So somebody like Jules Verne was sometimes publishing kind of science fiction, but also sometimes publishing, you know, adventures in deepest Africa or something like that. But I think actually Gernsback, he's interesting because he actually did have this vision that sort of new communications technologies, he was very interested in, like, radio and building your own radios and things like that, and other kinds of, like, tinkering and invention were really going to change day-to-day life. And so he had what he actually ended up publishing never quite lived up to the vision he outlined in his editorials, but he did have this really interesting vision of sort of everyday sort of, you know, garage tinkering, people making inventions and changing lives. They very often were getting rich as well, so that's not a adverse to that as a motivation. But I do think his aspirations sort of exceeded his grasp. But in a way, I find interesting. I think I have more patience for Gernsback than for Campbell, for example.
I can see that. But I want to stick with that idea of colonialism in early science fiction. It's one of those things that when I read that section of the book, I had never thought of it. I mean, it makes perfect sense now that you wrote it out. But this idea of European colonialism as a tradition in early science fiction, when we're talking about people like Wells and Verne, is really there. When I think of some of Verne's pieces, like of Tigers and Traitors, I think that
was
one.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, all that's about European colonialism. But even later, when we're dealing with aliens, there's a colonial aspect to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even something like The War of the Worlds, it is like reversing that colonial narrative and imagining, like, well, what if invaders came to London and the Imperial Center? But I think the colonial worldview, even if science fiction is not always reinforcing that worldview, and I think a lot of really exciting science fiction, especially stuff being written today in the 21st century, is all about, like, dismantling colonial attitudes, thinking through the power dynamics of colonialism. But the genre and imagining, like, what if you met people who were really, really different from yourselves, and you had to figure out how to communicate with them or how to interact with them.
Right.
Like, that's essentially a worldview that becomes possible with colonialism.
Well, I think about of film series like Avatar and Star Wars, too. And the how would you talk about them in relationship to the colonial impulse?
Yeah, so, I mean, Avatar is a lot, actually, like those Grimmsback
really
boys' adventure stories, yeah. Actually. I mean, I kind of don't like Avatar very much. I know a lot of people were moved by the sort of depiction of the alien life and the kind of harmony among life and a sort of, like, indigenous worldview. But, I mean, essentially, it's like a colonial adventure narrative where the white character goes to this place, you know, is able to use its values and its technology better than the indigenous people can, and then kind of like save them from others of himself.
It's a pretty old story.
Yeah. So I'm not the biggest fan of Avatar. And then something like Star Wars too, especially the sort of original series. I mean, I think that is very much trying to like work through America's relationship to something like the occupation of Vietnam. Oh. And on the one hand, you want to imagine yourself as the like rebel forces and not the sort of evil imperialist, because it's also a time of like the counterculture in America. But the imaginary of how you think that through is basically like a big space opera battle, which is, again, very much like the Grimmsback days of science fiction.
And this brings up an obvious point, it's sort of that this is all nestles in, and that's the whiteness of science fiction for a lot of the early years, right up until today, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a lot less white today. And in fact, some of the most celebrated and most exciting writers now are writers of color.
Absolutely.
But there's still problems with this sort of, as with America as a whole, problems with a sort of default structural racism that presumes certain things, that privilege whiteness. And then there were, I mean, there's a story, I can't remember if I talk about it in this book or not, but Samuel Delaney, who is one of the most celebrated writers of the sort of 50s and 60s, and did write for Campbell, that Campbell said things to him like, you know, the readership wouldn't relate to a black protagonist, so he wanted him to change the ethnicity of the protagonist. So there, especially in sort of the bad old days when a certain set of editors had a lot of control, and I mean, Campbell's notorious. He like told people to change the endings of their stories. Like he had a certain ideological view that stories had to align to and things like that. But now we see things like Rosarium Publishing or Future Fire Publishing, or there's another imprint called New Suns. Like so many imprints that are interested in finding and publishing work that is decolonial, that is by communities of color. There's science fiction being written in the Middle East. There's science fiction being written in Africa. There's science fiction being written in Latin America. So the sort of whiteness of science fiction and a particular colonial worldview that was embodied in that, all kinds of people are writing back to and against that tradition now.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Cheryl Vint. She's professor of media and cultural studies and of English at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about her new book. It's part of the MIT Press Essential Knowledge series. It's called Science Fiction. Cheryl, I want to talk about dystopias and utopias. Were there, in the old days, were there much more utopias? Because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of utopias anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in especially the 19th century, there was a lot of what I would call old school utopias. So utopia where it is like, this is the perfect society. This
right.
is how it works. Yeah.
And you bring back that message to Earth or wherever you went in time or something like that. And then
exactly.
That's what, yeah, that's the society we want. That's the one.
Yeah. But I mean, then there was, and so that sort of didn't last very long because it kind of, you know, comes up against reality. And not to mention, I mean, the difficulty with that old school model of utopia is that it's extremely rigid. And so any kind of rigid society is always like, you have to ask utopian for whom, right? It's clearly some people are not going to be served by that utopia. But in the sort of 1970s, a number of writers like Ursula Le Guin in The Dispossessed or Samuel Delaney in Triton wrote what critic Tom Moylan talks about as the critical utopia.
Yeah.
And so I think we still see utopias of that sort today as well. So the critical utopia, you know, is about trying to create the good society, but really it's about like that the ongoing struggle to figure that out so that the utopia itself is not perfect. Some things don't work. It's continually in adjustment. And so that sort of inaugurates the whole tradition of thinking of utopia as a kind of process rather than a goal or destination that you can arrive at. And I do think we see works today that still participate in that imaginary. Especially media works tend more towards the dystopian. And I don't know if that's because you can have much better sort of special effects if things are dystopian. But I think even the dystopias, they always have like a core of utopianism in the sense that they're warnings not to go that way, right? Like even something like, say, Elysium, which is a dystopia, it has a like not super convincing utopian ending, but it does have that like desire that when you find yourself in the utopia or the dystopia rather, what can you do to like transform that society? So it starts to move towards the utopian. So I think the two are always sort of present in interacting rather than they're one, you have a full utopia or a full dystopia.
One of the things you mentioned in the book, and I thought I had never thought about this, but it's obviously true, in that the young adult fiction market, dystopian is dominant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there why do you think that is? Is it just that teenagers are naturally glum?
I don't think necessarily, actually, because I think I'm not an expert in children's lit, but if I think back to the stuff I was reading when I was a child myself,
yeah.
I don't think dystopia has always been the dominant in children's lit, so I don't think it's that teenagers are glum. I do think it is about things like climate change, because so many of them are about climate change, right? That the young generation today has inherited a whole bunch of problems that seem intractable and are certainly like daunting, related to climate change or related to, you know, decades of economic inequality or related to ongoing systemic racism. And so if you have the YA books, which focus on young protagonists, basically that is their world, right, is inheriting the problems of the older generation and trying to figure out how to fix it. So it doesn't surprise me that dystopia sells very well to that audience, because I think in many ways that's a burden that they've inherited, that this is a generation that has to sort of reckon with a lot of problems decades in the making.
It's amazing how that's become popular in film too, besides the written form. When I think of all the film series that came out of young adult fiction, it's incredible. All of them are really grim visions of the future.
Yeah, like something like the Hunger Games, or the Maze Runner series is actually the one that gets me, that because they basically, and I'm surprised to find how often this is, but they do have these storylines that are essentially about like the adults preying on the younger generation
right.
in a certain kind of way,
using them for experiments.
Yeah,
I know, it's
exactly.
Really bleak.
So I don't think, like, when I was a kid, I think we were reading, like, sort of Bildungsroman kind of things about how you have to go out into the big, scary world and figure out your own place. But I don't think the older generation was sort of, like, actively conspiring against you.
I'm much older than you, Cheryl. So when I grew up and read science fiction as a young adult, I was reading things like Robert Heinlein and authors like that. So it was like, have spacesuit, we'll travel. And there was some, you know, Farmers in the Sky and all the sort of the classic old stuff. Yeah, there was some screwed up stuff, but it was always like, in the end, you knew it was going to be okay. In the more contemporary ones, you're not really sure it's going to be okay in the end.
No. And I do think that, like, as well as you sometimes see the older generation preying on the young, you also see, like them being incompetent. And this is why people that are 14, 15, 16 have to take on leadership roles. Like, they have a better vision for the future than the adults in so many of these things as well.
I want to, you set up a series of chapters on different themes after you get some of the initial material done in the beginning. And I want to talk about one in particular. I'd love to talk about robots and transhumans. that seems to be such a huge, AI seems to be such a huge theme within the last 15 years. And especially even on made for TV series, like the remake of Westworld, which is about as dystopian as you can get and mean-spirited, and I love it. But but the early ones, when I think of, first of all, we should talk about where the word robot comes from. It's rather old.
Yeah, absolutely. It comes from a 1921 play by Carol Chapek, and it's a word that means like indentured servant or serf. It's a Czech word that brings that term into English as robot, which they, you might recall this, but it used to be pronounced quite differently.
Because,
the emphasis was on the other syllable than how we say robot today. But I do think like that question, like fantasies of free labor or fantasies of laborers that can do, you know, have a competence to do all this work without supervision, but yet you don't have to treat them as people.
Because like, they're robots.
Sort of at the heart, yeah.
So it's slavery without the guilt is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's a colonial fantasy too, right? And I think we see, I mean, it's so popular today because we have all these algorithms and smart systems that are, you know, it's always threatening to take jobs. Like, I can't tell you how many books I've read in the last year that are all about the future of work or the end of work or a world without work. So that it's interesting. I think that's part of, you know, the robots used to be always more threatening, like the sort of Terminator robots. And now often you see something like, say, the television series Humans.
Robots
are the sympathetic characters. And I think that has a lot to do with, like, we used to imagine, like, oh, we will be these overlords getting robots to do all these things for us. And now we're more like, oh, robots are taking our jobs. And, like, what, we're going to be outside the economy, and what will that look like? So suddenly there's this sympathy with robots. Although the Carol Chapek's play, he was quite sympathetic to the robots
as well,
the original. Yeah.
But there's also been a sexualization of robots, too. And even when I think of go back to the film Metropolis, Fritz Lang's, there is definitely a sexual element.
Yeah, I mean, I think that...
And when I think about Humans, that's part of it too.
Well, one of the biggest industries in robotics is sex robots, right? And teledildonics and all that kind of thing. So there's a lot of money to be made. So it's unsurprising that robots are sexualized. Just because, I mean, if there's money to be made, that's where an industry is going to go. With Maria and Metropolis, I mean, certainly she's sexualized and she's definitely evil, but I think that has as much to do with, like, just plain old misogyny sort of women are, like, you know, disrupting the workers' solidarity than it necessarily is about her being a robot. But if you think of, like, a film like Ex Machina, I think that's a really fascinating
examination. Let's talk about that for a second, because as you write in your book, that was soundly criticized from several quarters.
Yeah, I actually really like that film, but I know a lot of people...
I like it too, but it's got parts of it that make you feel uneasy, but I always had the feeling that that's what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, for instance, that Kyoko, the Asian robot, that at first you think he's just treating an Asian woman that way because you don't know she's a robot initially. It says a lot about the kind of gendered and racialized imaginary that informs how we imagine robots, right?
Well, I thought the point of that in the movie was to reveal the fact that this guy who was supposedly so brilliant still harbored these horrible sexist, racist viewpoints about Asian women.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I agree. And not only harbors them, but in fact, like...
acted on them.
Makes his designs based on them, right? And so the... I know a lot of people don't like it because Ava manipulates Caleb and leaves him trapped, but I am sort of on her side.
Yeah, I don't think it's a wrong thing. I hope she does well.
I agree. And I think, I mean, she's been taught by humans that what you do to different people is, like, lock them up and emotionally manipulate them.
That's
so
right.
If that's the lesson she learned, like, you know, it's unsurprising, you know?
One last thing. I want to talk. There's a lot of things under cyberpunk that you were talking about. And, you know, this coming of the technological singularity. But you have these extropians. Can you just mention that for a second? Because I had never heard of that before.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the extropians are still around, but they don't call themselves extropians anymore. They call themselves transhumanists, and a lot of them are associated with Humanity Plus.
Augmented human bodies augmented by machinery?
Sometimes augmented by machinery, but also there's a deep interest in sort of like biohacking in various ways. So supplements and other kinds of like life extension ideas or different kinds of chemicals you could take to make your brain work better. So, I mean, the sort of the Ray Kurzweil version is mind upload is sort of the horizon of immortality. But there is like also this idea that you can somehow like achieve immortality as well. So back in the 90s when all this stuff was like, you know, really new and heady and listservs and things like that, there was a lot of overlap between the extropians who were basically into like body hacking and new capacities that you could engineer into your body or longer life. And then a lot of people who went on to develop like cryonics and the Alcor and things like that.
Oops.
And then also a group calling themselves cypherpunks, who through a range of iterations became the kind of crypto community that eventually developed Bitcoin. So there's a lot of like interesting overlaps in those imaginaries.
We're going to be out of time, and we could talk about this book for hours. We've just scratched the surface. I want to tell the audience that. My guest tonight has been Cheryl Vint. She's professor of media and cultural studies and of English at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about her book titled simply Science Fiction. Cheryl, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.